Billie Holiday would have been 100 years old this very day. We've been spending the morning listening to so many of her songs and reading the book. The author is who we're talking to this hour. The author of Billie Holiday, The Musician and the Myth. John Zwed says that what he wanted to do really was look at a lot of aspects of her that maybe other biographers have not done, to look at why it was that her autobiography created such an uproar, how do we find the truth about her life, but more importantly, and what interested him most, he says, is the musical detail, her ideas about the meaning of music, the ideology of jazz, her understanding of race in jazz and also in America, her accounts of what shaped her musical development, which is also fascinating. He says that she is justly considered to be the greatest jazz singer of all time. And what a biography she has. It's really quite an amazing story. So we're delighted to speak with the author of Billie Holiday this hour. John has been on the show before. He's a former professor of music and director of the Center for Jazz Studies at Columbia University. He played as a jazz musician professionally for a number of years, and he's the author of many books, including So What? The Life of Miles Davis, Space is the Place, The Lives and Times of Sun Ra, or Sun Ray, and Alan Lomax, the man who recorded The World. We'll be welcoming phone calls, and we'll be hearing some Billie Holiday during the course of the hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. You can also find us on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. Hello, John. Thank you very much for being with us, and we look forward to this hour. Hi. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen. Nice to talk to you again.
Yeah, great to have you here. So was she born in Baltimore in 1915 of parents who were just a couple of kids, just to put her in a place in time, because I always like to know about the early lives of people. That was how she began her autobiography.
She began the way she thought it was. She was actually born in Philadelphia, not too far from where we are right now. And her mother at the time was a maid for Ethel Waters, Ethel Waters being an enormous talent at the time and largely forgotten, unfortunately, in our time. A very strange way to come into show business yourself when your mother has been a maid to a star, but she was also a maid to Mildred Bailey's. Then her stepmother was a maid for, at any rate, what we're talking about is the limited possibilities that black women had for occupations in that
right.
period, and it was not unlikely that people's mothers would have been maids. And it was something that Holiday herself detested, the idea of being a maid. And she was not amused when Ethel Waters played a maid in the films. She may have gotten an Academy Award for it, as I recall, and said, it's better to play a maid than to be a maid. It was not convincing to Holiday. In fact, late in life, one of her last sort of public pleas, because she'd been barred from performing in nightclubs in New York, the center of nightclub life, because the police controlled who could perform or not, and she had a drug felony, so she was basically put out of work. And she said, "My name is Billie Holiday, and I sing for a living. What can I do if they won't let me be a singer? Do I have to go back to be a maid as I started out?"
Interesting.
It was on her mind.
Yeah. You write that she is seen by some as a literary figure, along with Zora Neale Hurston, as one of the first to fashion complex narratives about the lives of black women, and therefore a predecessor to the likes of Toni Morrison. Talk more about that. That's an interesting thought.
Well, it may be a stretch, but it struck me that this is, as far as public narratives where people create fictional people who are close to real life, her songs form a kind of, the word came up, the word I want to use came up in my book. I wouldn't have thought of otherwise. Someone said that her songs were like cycles, and the cycles are a classical term, meaning you pick songs that are of a type, a mode, a subject, a tempo, even keys that are common, and you build a long narrative evening out of these things. This is the way Lieder is done by singers of German and so on. I thought her songs had that kind of force, and in fact, I should have mentioned that Zora Neale Hurston also wrote songs. In fact, this is missing from all of her biographies, but there's proof of it in the Library of Congress, where she has copyrights on a number of songs. One of them actually became something of a minor hit called Jelly, Look What You Done to Me. She was a novelist, yes, but she was writing songs that were like small novels. I think Holiday was, too.
Yeah, and you talk about people in New York, if you were a painter, you wanted to paint her. If you were some man who crossed paths with her, you wanted to marry her. If you wanted to write a song about her, that she had all of these people from the artistic world and beyond who were captivated by her. What were the qualities that were captivating about her that made so many people of so many different walks of life want to be up close?
I actually learned about this when I found an earlier draft of her book, Lady Sings the Blues, her autobiography, and certain key figures were missing from it, or their place in the in her life were watered down for fear of litigation. In a couple cases, people had already threatened litigation, and others they hadn't. Her affair with Orson Welles when he was probably at his peak, at the early part of his life, just having finished Citizen Kane and starting on The Magnificent Ambersons. But also the fact that she had fans who were very high in the social order and in society, that is, and also in show business. People like Bob Hope was a huge fan. I unfortunately left out that Ava Gardner, knowing they both had both she and Billy had great taste for dogs. She must have run into each other at a dog show in L.A., and she bought Billy two very expensive chihuahuas, a pair of champions. She was also involved with an heiress an heiress of the DuPont fortune and another one from one of the big tobacco companies. What do these people see? They all spoke about a person who was extremely sensitive to meaning and musical meaning and nuance of music. And this is not something we're privy to at this point because we weren't that close and she didn't give that many interviews and didn't do that many films. But the testimony of people like a Yale professor who was a great harpsichordist, Ralph Kirkpatrick, who said that she had this wonderful sense of the rightness of the Baroque music he was playing on the harpsichord, or a Midwestern classical composer, Ned Roram, who wrote her into her spirit, at least, into some of his pieces after he talked about how sensitive she was. Also her humor, which turns up not so easily in the usual places, but she was very, very funny. I'd like to tell some of the things she said, but we can't get them on the air, but they are hysterical nonetheless. And they usually involve people who are pompous and overblown and exceeding whatever they should be, and she brings them down rapidly. Anyway, she was a very complex person. I didn't see this multidimensional, rich part even in her autobiography, and I think that's because the book was written largely to try to get her career back in gear by acknowledging the things that she'd been accused of and, in one case, convicted of. And saying, I wasn't a victim, I made these choices, and that's what I did.
Right.
Today, you know, she operated alone, as I think most stars at one point did, particularly African-American women stars. They had no entourages, per se. They had no security. They had, in Billy's case, she had no agent for a long time, no lawyer. Jose James, the singer, said just the other day that if it were now, Billy might be say that she's in rehab and, you know, call Oprah. there's at least now ways you can handle these things. At that time, she armed herself. In fact, I found out that most singers, black and white women singers, in the 30s and 40s were armed. They had rough lives.
Interesting.
And they were often thought of as the next thing to a prostitute, since they were traveling with all men.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to Orson Welles for a moment, because it puts the music and their affair and where we were as a country on issues of race and war kind of front and center. He wanted to make a movie. Can you give us the background on this? And then Pearl Harbor happened, and also he was dealing with some issues that RKO, I believe, didn't want to have front and center, because people in Iowa and people in Missouri and people south of the Mason-Dixon would not stand for blacks and whites being on screen together.
Yes, Orson was is a fascinating character, a frustrating person to think about, because he, you know, ultimately he became a blowhard and a windbag. I mean, but he was extremely intelligent and had, I like to think, giving him the best of it, that he was such a genius that he was thinking faster than he could possibly ever do. Carry out and complete what he was doing, but he was open to every possibility. He was very interested in the early part of the 40s, when he would have been around 22, 23, something like that. He was very aware of injustice and about racial matters and other things, but he was also a big jazz fan in the older sort of thing, maybe interested in, say, New Orleans musicians rather than swing musicians. And when he first got a radio show, he had a house band that was full of New Orleans jazz musicians. And he had this dream of doing a film that would talk about the history of jazz as an enormous cultural achievement in America, and it would really be the Louis Armstrong story. And he had Armstrong signed up for it. He had Duke Ellington as the music director and artistic director. He had people from Disney's group who had worked on Fantasia involved with it. It was going to be something really incredible. Billie Holiday would play Bessie Smith, which is kind of strange casting, but whatever. And Hazel Scott would play Louis Armstrong's wife, another strange piece of casting. But the film never came about because World War II started, and Welles was sent south to Brazil to create a film, what they call the Good Neighbor Policy. There was fear that Brazil, being neutral in the war, might turn pro-fascist. Mm. So the idea was to sort of, with the help of leadership there, show the connection between democracy in both countries and so on. He overspent his budget. He was trying to find a way to put both New Orleans and Rio together because they had common historical bases and some rough similarities between music, at least, and the importance of the average person there. But the studio was very, as you suggested, was very unhappy with the prominence of people of color in the film, because particularly in the Brazilian footage that he shot, he made a point of going to every neighborhood, and increasingly you saw people of color dominating over white people. Now, he was going to do the same thing in the Armstrong story, and there was already doubts about that. What's weird is that after those two failures, and not making either of the films he wanted to make, that in 1947, pieces of the script were taken up and remade into a film called New Orleans, which Billie Holiday and Louis Armstrong were in. But the same thing happened again. The producers objected to the number of stars who were African-American.
Goodness.
And that film, if you've ever seen it, has some very strange... here you see Billie Holiday as a maid in a very rich white person's house, but also at nighttime as extremely polished and sophisticated woman in beautiful clothes. Hmm. So you have this double-sided thing. And then the twist of the movie is that the daughter of the wealthy white people wants to live that life, and she sort of cons her maid into taking her to this other world. By the time the film was made, though, they had decided to phase out a number of black people, so at the end, they totally disappear. And everybody playing jazz at the end is all white.
Ah,
a very strange film.
So tell me, we tend to think of people going to conservatories now, of spending years and years studying jazz. We have you, a professor of music and director of the Center for Jazz Studies at Columbia University, for a long time. How do you have somebody who's only had a fifth grade education understand the nuance of phrasing and become the greatest jazz singer of all times during... We would think that you would be taking a completely different path if you were doing that these days. How did that happen in her life?
It might turn around the other way. How did it happen that we have schools doing this now? You could argue, are they really teaching anything? I never studied music formally. I was only a musician. But
really?
The fact that I got to be professor is one of the wonders of my life. I'm not going to push the point too hard. I don't know. The problem is that Holiday has survived in a way that other singers haven't, and you can see some of her the features of her singing that are shared by some others who did last. It's Frank Sinatra's 100th birthday coming up soon too, and both of them were connected at one point. They were pals, and I found this little. Well, there are two things. One is a well-known statement that in the early 50s that Sinatra made, that she was the most important singer for the last 20 years and everyone had been influenced by her, and certainly himself, he said. But it's also a little item I found in a Los Angeles paper from the early 40s where someone's asking her about being seen around Chicago with Frank Sinatra, and said, yeah, they were going around when they were both working there. They went to various places. And then the interviewer said... Well, Sinatra says you influenced him a great deal. How did that work out? She said, I gave him some hints about phrasing and about how he could bend some notes and what have you. And he said, but Billy, you're not commercial, meaning I can't get away with that kind of thing. She said, but, you know, that's what he meant. I taught him a few things like that. And she brushes it off as saying it wasn't really important. But what she was doing in her song... It's very hard to talk about. It's hard to talk about either in musical terms, if you're very sophisticated in music, and I could give you examples of people saying they can't do it in a standard musical way, and even a poetic or, metaphorical way. It's just hard. By some measures, she would be a non-singer. But in fact, she shows a kind of a level of achievement which is absolutely extraordinary and probably unique. I'll give one example.
Okay.
If you chart out, and it's very hard to do, but I fortunately had some students who did it. If you chart out where the beat is in the song that she's singing, and if you take the sheet music, which has a beat in it too, and you put those together, and then you draw the lines connecting where she's coming down on the beat in the words she's singing, you find that she's virtually never on the beat of either the original music or the musicians. Mm-hmm. Now, if you were to say to a singer now, I want you to sing this song, but never come down on the beat with anyone else, they're out the door. There's no way to do it. Somehow she knew how to do this. Now, it's heard by us normally as lagging, that she's behind the beat, which is kind of a very modern thing. A lot of singers, even rappers, do this sort of thing now. But it was really remarkable at the time. And if you listen closely to singers like, let me take someone that would stretch this, Doris Day. Doris Day also has a little of that laid-back thing, and sounds at times like Billie Holiday. If I'm wrong, everyone can correct me, but I hear it that way.
All right. Well, let's hear a little Billie Holiday, because now you have me hungry to hear her again and to hear what you were just talking about. We'll be welcoming phone calls. Unfortunately, we can't compare the Doris Day with Billie Holiday, but you can do that on your own sometime today. I love this arrangement. We played a wee bit of it earlier, but Billie Holiday with My Man. You're familiar with this song, and we'll be welcoming phone calls. It is Billie Holiday's 100th birthday today, and our guest is the author of Billie Holiday, The Musician and the Myth. John Zwed is with us. John is a former professor of music and director of the Center for Jazz Studies at Columbia University and a jazz musician who played professionally for a number of years. Considered the best, most famous, most accomplished jazz singer of all times, she has survived. Her records, you'll know her voice when you hear it. If you've never heard her before, you'll know this particular voice because it's very unique. And her story was tough, and some of what she sang about, we'll talk about the courageousness of her singing Strange Fruit and hear some of that as the hour progresses. But here's how you reach the conversation as we talk about Billie Holiday. 800-486-8655 is the number. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. A little bit of Billie before we return.
Sometimes I say if I just could get away with my man, he'd go straight to your ass, babe, for it never is too late for a man. I'd just like to dream of a cottage by a stream with my man, where a few flowers grew and perhaps a kid or two like my man. And then my eyes get wet, I most forget, till he gets hot and tells me not to talk such rot. Oh, my man, I love him so he'll never know. All my life is just despair, but I don't care. When he takes me in his arms, the world is right, all right. What's the difference if I say I'll go away, when I know I'll come back on my knees someday?
Billie Holiday, we're celebrating her 100th birthday. She would have been 100 today, with the author of Billie Holiday, The Musician and the Myth. John Sweat is our guest, and we're welcoming phone calls for him at 800-486-8655. Carl in Milwaukee is our first caller. Hi, Carl.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead, Carl.
Yeah, I was loving your show. And with John's comment, I heard Billie Holiday, when I first heard Doris Day sing Sentimental Journey, I thought, my goodness, Doris Day could have been a Billie Holiday type singer, because she sounded so much like Billie Holiday. I thought, wow, she could have gone that direction too, Doris Day, that is. Of course, Billie Holiday is wonderful, so, but I just made that comment. I thought it was John's comment I agree with a lot.
Thank you, Carl, for the call.
Thank you.
You agree, John? Yeah.
Yeah, and I'm trying to think of the film which everything she sings is like, oh, wait a minute, Young Man with a Horn with Kirk Douglas, which turns up on television very, very occasionally. But everything in that has that sort of that delayed feeling, which is not quite delayed. If it were really delayed, if she was really that far behind the beat, when the band stops, she'd still be singing. So it's a question of moving the beat around, which is what she's doing. And mm-hmm. Yeah, I hear it in lots of singers, and even today. Although it's an extremely hard thing to do and not make a fool of yourself or lose your listeners. And the other problem is that, or the other feature of her that's so striking, is her diction is so good. You always know what she's saying.
Yes.
Same with Sinatra, when so many singers aren't that good.
I really am a stickler about that. I can't hear the words, it drives me nuts. I want to hear what people are saying. So I'm glad that she does that.
Good luck with that.
Right, I know. How true. When did the heroin start and why?
She was never perfectly clear on that. Her friend said it was a husband of hers who was himself an addict and a drug dealer and it ended up in prison. She spoke very roughly about her three husbands, but never was precise about it. Drugs entered the country during that period. I mean, they entered in waves at different times, starting with marijuana and getting more serious as they went along. And it's worth remembering that some of these drugs were, well, all of these drugs were legal at one point. They were either legal because they weren't quite sure what they would do or because they weren't even noticing that they were there. So a number of people became addicted before there was any legal problem going on. What went crazy about it is that, at least in New York, the one place I could speak about, is that public hospitals were forbidden to treat drug addicts. You know, they all had to deal either on their own or find a doctor that would operate outside. Billie Holiday went to the hospital for heart trouble and for liver problems, and when they saw marks on her arm, they left her in the hall, figuring that she has to go somewhere else. Mm. That seems extremely strange, particularly when they're putting people in jail for this kind of thing. But I would stress the fact that people didn't quite know what they were getting into, and this also applied to people during World War I and World War II who got drugs for medical purposes that no one had any idea of just how powerful they were. And a number of people who weren't in the category we would normally call an addict were addicted. It became even weirder when to get into a federal hospital that when they created such things, such as in Lexington, to get to one of these drug hospitals, you had to have committed a crime. And it was not unusual for people to dream up a crime and admit to it in court so they could get treatment. Mm.
Tell us the story of Tallulah Bankhead. It's an interesting story, who decides that has been arrested in California for possession and can't get a cabaret card, which keeps her out of being able to do what she does for a living. And she decides to get a hold of J. Edgar Hoover?
Well,
it's quite a story.
I can barely believe the story of Tallulah Bankhead. I've now read her book and several others, and you continue to say, no, this didn't happen. I hope some people have at least seen her in some of her film appearances. The one that's easiest to see is, what is it? There are a bunch of people on a raft at sea with, I'm failing the name, it's a Hitchcock film. She's a very beautiful woman, a Southern belle, in every sense of the word. Her father was an heir to a large plantation, and he was Speaker of the House for a while. A very important guy. And also, for a Southerner from Alabama, he was a left-winger. That is, he backed Roosevelt and labor unions, but he was such a well-liked person, they were willing to forgive him those kind of sins at the time. At any rate, she never was educated either as an actress or in anything beyond private education at home, and she was indulged and went off to study, to get into acting, and did very well in London, where she also was extremely eccentric and flamboyant in a way that you can't quite get away with in the United States at that period. People thought she was just crazy or wanton or something, not eccentric or odd. So to have those two come together is strange. And they were very close, to put it mildly. And when Billie got into trouble, Tallulah thought she could use the connection she had with J. Edgar Hoover because of her father's political position. They knew each other. And she wrote him a very sweet letter in which she talked about, you'll understand this, it's really important. She's a poor girl, she's got these problems, and she's been, used by people and so on. And Hoover wrote back very nicely, and he knew her, of course, and said, but these aren't my charges. These were local charges, and they're not. And then this is a follow-up letter in which she becomes almost abusive, switching from the Southern Belle to the Southern Tornado, saying, but you've got all these cops out there. What are they doing arresting people? What do you mean you have nothing to do with this? And so on. Then she backs away again into the Southern Belle, as I recall, and this went on. But they end up on a phone call, a three-way phone call. It's just hard to believe, in which she's making the pitch. And at one point, she says, we all have times of the day when we're just worn out and we need a kind of, a lift of some sort. A little drugs after work is not that bad, right? And Billy's saying, cool it. You'll be in prison forever if you keep this up.
Oh, what a trio. Let's talk a little bit about the autobiography. Not a whole lot, but you begin with this, and it's been, as you write, poured over for years by biographers in search of the truth. If she did falsify some information about herself, why did she do so? How does her autobiography fit into your biography?
Well, I thought I thought that the story of that book is more complex than I knew. I just sensed it was, and I found out from letters that I was privileged to get and some documents show that the co-writer and she worked more closely than anyone thought, and that where people just blew this book off as hack writing and I don't know, whatever. It wasn't a hack. The co-writer was an outstanding writer, and she was contributing in a serious way to the book. I think people didn't like what they read in it, so they tended to dismiss it and find ways to dismiss it as they went along. It was a very self-serving book in that she was trying to get licenses back so that she could perform and was trying to make the case for what happened to it. She didn't blame others for it, rather took the blame herself, and she wasn't a victim as she conceived it. And I think even that was not liked by a lot of people. But I got a review from someone in The New Yorker who I think correctly said, I should have pointed out that the book was brave in a way that I hadn't underlined enough. It was brave that she was exposing her life to everyone and saying, this is the trouble I got into. And it was not quite, you know, don't try this at home, kids. It was more like, here's what happened, period. Mm-hmm. But she also is indicting the United States at the time for a series of incredibly stupid things, such as not treating addicts and putting them in jail, and then they come back out and they're addicts again. Mm-hmm. If I sound like I'm talking about now, of course I am as well. But also the fact that the FBI was on a rampage against actors and mainly actors. To make them the poster children of the drug wars, in the first drug war. So you had people like the drummer Gene Krupa, or a name I always forget, Robert Mitchum, Billie Holiday picked out as people who would not only be arrested and followed, but they'd be followed for the rest of their lives. This is a very expensive and very destructive way to do things. Add this to the hospital thing, to the prisons and so forth, and it was a system of that was basically out of control and still never quite been controlled since that time. So I found the book, I found the pieces that were missing from the book, and I could put some of this back in and try to figure out what's going on. Whatever it is, she was enormously brave to do this. Let's just look back to the mid-50s. You didn't talk about these things in public.
Right.
The gossip magazines weren't gossiping by real names. You had to guess. Confidential was just coming into existence as Billie Holiday died, the first real magazine of this sort. So besides that, at this point, the only thing that ever been made public was people's drunkenness or their alcoholism, but not their drug addiction. So I think for a woman and for a black woman to do this in the mid-50s is an enormously heroic act.
Mm-hmm. As you recall, you have to compare it with other things coming out, and Bing Crosby, who had his own serious issues with alcoholism, the book about him was, you know, cheery, cheery, cheery.
Right, and he seemed to be protected by the press. I found an article where one journalist actually said this, said, why are they giving him this free ride? I don't know that much about him, but I do know that he was one of the first singers to have a show, and for the first week of his performances, he wasn't showing up because he was drunk. And yet they just kept stalling until he came in and sober enough to sing. But he was always considered a family man and so on. Now, I could also turn to Ethel Waters, who was a singer of note before Billy. And if you read Ethel Waters' book, His Eyes on the Sparrow, she's had a life just about as bad as Billy's and talks about it. The thing is that she, at the end, had won an Academy Award and had joined Billy Graham's traveling company.
Wow.
So people were willing to forgive her of things that Billie Holiday didn't have, I think.
Mm-hmm. We welcome more phone calls. When we return, we're going to come into the next part of our conversation, so keep your ears tuned to this Strange Fruit, the song that was very brave of her to sing and somewhat revolutionary in the time that it was written and the time that it was sung. So we will talk to John about that, and we'll play a portion of Strange Fruit, which is about a lynching, as I'm sure many of you know, after we hear just a few announcements. And welcome your phone calls. Today would have been the 100th birthday of Billie Holiday. Our guest has written a wonderful biography of her and all her complexity and all her brilliance. Billie Holiday, the musician and the myth. John Swed is our guest. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page, if you would like to go there, is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about Billie Holiday this hour on this, her 100th birthday.
Southern trees bear strange fruit. Blood on the leaves and blood at the root. Black bodies swinging in the southern breeze. Strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees. Pastoral scene of the gallant south. The bulging eyes and the twisted mouth. Scent of magnolia, sweet and fresh. Then the sudden smell of burning flesh.
Billie Holiday.
Here is a fruit.
And Strange Fruit. Oh, that song is hard to listen to still. It's just, it must have been very courageous for her to sing that song, was it not?
Courageous and dangerous. I think most people at the time never heard the song, but they read about it and, or heard it in some way or another. It was on a very small recording label. And maybe from even now, most people haven't heard it, but heard about it. The last part, the verse you played is one that's missing from Diana Ross's version in the film. It was, you know, apparently too heavy for Barry Gordy to put in as well. Mm. It's missing from the Glee songbook, for that matter. It's still being censored, and it was censored on radio in a number of places. This was taking pop song into a zone that it had never gone to, and when she was singing it live, it was more pointed. You don't go to nightclubs to be educated in that way, and you don't. It was upsetting and extraordinarily dangerous to do this, and would be today even so.
Mm-hmm. And so, why did she do it?
Well, that's an interesting thing, because people who were apparently close to this said that she didn't quite know what she was getting into, and it struck her. But that's nothing I found supported that. She knew what she was doing from the beginning. How could she not have known what she was doing?
Sure.
It's not that tricky. It's in your face. I don't know what to, that song is tough to have to reckon with. The whole concept is.
Mm-hmm.
What singer would sing it today?
Mm-hmm. Right, exactly. I don't know.
I mean, as originating the song rather than copying it.
Right. Let's go to phone calls. Heather in Bloomer. Hi, Heather.
Hi, Kathleen. What an interesting show. I was wondering when Strange Fruit was going to be mentioned. It is probably the most haunting song that I've ever heard. I taught for years at the Chippewa County Alternative School. And in teaching there, I devised a class called Teaching Tolerance. This is a song that I played for my students, and then, of course, they had no idea what the Strange Fruit was.
Mm.
But in teaching it, I was able to go back to that time that these children certainly didn't know about, I knew about, of the lynchings in the South. It was pretty powerful then. It was pretty powerful for my students, and it's as powerful today as it was then. Thanks so much for discussing this.
Thank you so much for your call. And when it came to matters of race, She wouldn't have had to do much more than sing that song, which would have been a huge contribution from anybody's life in a courageous act. What about race playing out in her life in terms, and we've talked about Orson Welles some and that, but were there lots of instances of discrimination that she had to face, of instances of racism that she wanted to make front and centered that she talked about?
Well, yes, particularly at the early years, but after being charged with possession of drugs and getting a year-plus sentence with it, which marked her forever and didn't allow her to make a proper living, her concern was at a more basic level of some injustice that was operating in her life. She knew that this was a law that applied to white and blacks alike, and at that time, very few people actually were punished for this. The first war of drugs was more like a Sunday school lesson. We'll point out some famous people who were bad, and that's that, and maybe punish them with it. So they were given rough treatment and lifelong lasting treatment. People like, Robert Mitchum, who really was only charged with marijuana, was brave in his own way, and that people would rush to him. When he got out of prison, they asked him, would he do it again? he said something like, I never make threats to myself or promises to myself like that, especially as it went out. But he double-talked the thing, finally sort of saying, if I did, you wouldn't know about it, which was holding to some kind of principle in the process. And Gene Krupa had to apologize, the drummer, who they were weird. If Billie Holiday is seen as a black person and therefore a drug addict, Gene Krupa was seen as a drummer and therefore a drug addict. And I remember reading an old New Yorker column where Whitney Balliot said, how did he phrase this? Gene Krupa looked like what America thought a drummer sounded like. So we had these kind of, which I think it's also unusual to punish a woman in a new kind of crime like this. It's much like the parallel. It's not the same caliber. It's the same category of disparate punishment on capital punishment, of which very few women have actually been executed. Mm-hmm. It's funny. After I wrote it and hear people's responses to these things, I realized that I probably understated just how much this cost her, and how what a life would be like in which you were not only were you followed every time you worked with police, but you had people outside the building, as in the case of New York police, with warning people not to go into the apartment building, that a criminal was living there. It's an extraordinary set of gestures. One of the cases against her was titled United States versus Billie Holiday.
Goodness.
I'm laughing, but that sort of captures the whole story.
Yeah. Let's go to Kevin in Milwaukee. Hi, Kevin.
Hello. In Ken Burns' great jazz documentary, first Artie Shaw and then the narrator both make reference to two different incidents where Billie's faced with a pretty horrific racial attack in a public setting, one verbal, one there's a destruction of property, and she responds in a very vociferous manner, maybe appropriately. I wonder if you had any insights into that, or kind of speaking as to how the racism, both institutional and these attacks from just citizens, weighed on her and affected her career.
One thing I discovered, I have a short chapter called A Prehistory of a Singer. I wanted to show, because I didn't know and wanted to find out about it, what the singers before her were like, and when she surfaced, what was she? Was she going beyond them? Was she following patterns and so on? And I began to see something pretty astonishing. I read a book which is floating around there, but I doubt if many people have ever read Helen Forrest's book called Had the Craziest Dream. She was a singer who replaced Billie Holiday in in Artie Shaw's band. That was her big hit, The Craziest Dream. She was a Jewish American, not a black American. But she says that women singers were broadly believed to be wanton women and something one mark above a prostitute. So that set me looking at other things, and I began to see that where such things are known, women singers were armed. Dinah Washington carried a small pistol all the time. A razor was found. Billie Holiday carried a safety razor in her Kleenex box, which is, you may wonder about that, but safety.
Really?
That's not considered a deadly weapon. It's something that's just crazy, right? Whereas a straight razor would be. Yeah, that's the way the law was being interpreted. But then I realized that these women were, to survive, had to be really tough. I mean, physically tough. It required being able to punch people as well, and Billy certainly did that on occasion. But be prepared for death-dealing kinds of things. And musicians who worked with her in interviews that are in various libraries, like Smithsonian and Institute of Jazz Studies in Newark, document this with things they saw. And particularly things that were going on in New York, where soldiers were shipping out to Europe for war, and people from different parts of the country and different races were coming together, Southerners and black Americans, and all kinds of trouble was going around nightclubs, which I had no idea about. The bouncers were in effect came into existence because of this, the private security to throw people out.
We have we're going to end with a full Billie Holiday song because after all, it's her birthday. But I'm just wondering, did she have any great, you know, reciprocal love in her life that made everything good for a while, at least?
Well, it's a tough question. Close friends, particularly women singers who were close to her, said the only time she was happy was when she was performing. But I've heard that for other performers, maybe you have too. That for Ella Fitzgerald, it was said of her. And Ella Fitzgerald was a radically different kind of persona and woman than Billy. You know, she was the ingenue to Billy's and much beloved by Americans. But she was a person who whose confidant said she was only happy when she was performing as well, that the rest of her life was not that good. Which makes you want to draw a conclusion like, are these songs just the results of a person's personality? I didn't want to give in to that because I simply had thought about it, and I put it this way, that there are a lot of miserable people, but they're not great singers. And we're lucky.
Right.
So there's something special about the person who can turn any kind of song into a thing that will move people, make them cry, and make them share feelings with it. It's really about art. Uh-huh. It's really about the ability to, if I use the word actor here, I don't mean to say they're faking. They're just bringing a level of art to it that's not there otherwise. And this is what sets her apart from just a person who's miserable.
Mm-hmm. Oh, John, thank you so much for being with us. Thanks for writing the book. Enjoyed the hour.
And great to talk to you.
And happy birthday to Billie Holiday. Would have been 100. His book is Billie Holiday, the Musician and the Myth. John Swedes, S-Z-W-E-D is how you spell it. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this hour and to KP as well for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. Billie takes us up to the news.
But God bless the child that's got his own, that's got his own. Money, you got lots of friends crowding round the door. When you're gone and spending, relations give crust of bread and such. You can help yourself, but don't take too much. for me to have. But God bless the child that's got his own, that's got his own.